I wanted to talk to you about the World Heritage List, which is now, I don't know if you've looked recently, but it is now up to 890 sites. And on the tentative lists, if you go in, they're now all posted on the web also. They're probably ranging, if you did the addition, was around 1,500 or 2,000 more on the indicative list or tentative list, lists of countries. It raises the question of numbers and whether, and I don't know, you weren't there at the beginning of the convention, so you really don't know in a way what was in the minds of the creators of the convention, but the question really is in front of us. Is there a limit? Is there a time when there are too many sites on the list? Should the list be capped? How, or is it okay to just keep designating?
It's a good question because I wondered about it myself 20-odd years ago. On the one hand, the idea behind the convention was that there would be some number, and I don't think a number was ever identified, and I don't think that would have been fair to do so, but some limited number of places warranted not just recognition nationally or regionally, but internationally, worldwide. And the obvious ones, of course, were the Taj Mahal and pyramids of Egypt and that sort of thing. The early nominations were fairly easy because they included those, and they included Banff and Jasper, the Four Mountain National Parks, for example, the Grand Canyon, and so on. So they were pretty obvious, and nobody would really argue about those. As time went on, and as more countries signed the convention, I think maybe there was a perception that by signing the convention, it implied that there were sites within those member states that warranted nomination to the list. That may or may not be the case. If the idea is to have a truly representative, equal marks, if you like, group of nominations, then it would follow that there may be some countries that don't have those kinds of things, not for any reason of their doing, but for just the nature of the way the world evolved and the way political boundaries formed. It makes it difficult. I think in time, if the numbers go to, and I suspect the indicative list will grow gradually as well, but even if you added another 25 to 900, did you say? 3,500 World Heritage sites gets a little bit hard to try to get your mind around. The idea of categorizing them to A, B, and C sites doesn't have any appeal, I don't think, to anyone. And so it's a question. Maybe you give the World Heritage Committee another 5 or 10 years and put a lid on it. I don't think this kind of thing would necessarily go on forever because at some point you run out of those sites that would qualify for nomination. It's an interesting question and one that I think there are sites on it now that aren't justified, and I'll use one from Canada that I think I can say that without upsetting anybody else. But early on, Canada nominated or proposed, and the committee nominated the Four Mountain National Parks as a World Heritage Site, and that was agreed to. Some years later, after I had been chair of the committee, Canada and the U.S., for reasons that escape me, nominated Glacier Waterton National Parks to be on the World Heritage List, and it was approved. Both of those parks are duplication of the kind of natural features found in the Four Mountain Parks. And so, going back to the criteria and the operating procedures, they shouldn't have been put forward in the first place, and given that they were put forward, they shouldn't have been agreed to for nomination. So that's an example of the kind of things that I think the committee needs to be concerned about.
Do you have a view, just finishing up on this question, but what you raised earlier on is really a kind of debate that goes on within the committee, kind of between the cultural and the natural areas, related to best of the best and representative of the best, if I can kind of encapsulate it like that. And the argument on the cultural side is representative means it's as good as one other that is already on the list, whereas best of the best in the natural sense is the one that stands for a group of. Do you have a view on that?
No, I don't think the two descriptions are all that incompatible. Representative means that, and best of the best, I suppose, in the case of natural, enough is known about the natural ecosystems of the world to be able to reasonably identify down to a very few, I would think, so-called, quote, best of the best. That's not necessarily the case on the cultural side. There are many cultural sites on the list that are simply unique in their own right. Others are particular, and I think of cathedrals, Mont Saint-Michel. Mont Saint-Michel. Yeah, I mean that's quite unique, and I was surprised that it was not until the late 80s that it was put up for nomination. Some of the ruins in Greece, some of the Roman ruins in other countries, including the UK, I think are representative. One difficulty that the committee had, and certainly I had, was a nomination the UK put forward, and I don't mind talking about this because I talked about it at depth with UK representatives, was the Lake District in Northwest England. It was put forward at the time as both a natural site and a cultural site. Unfortunately, neither met the criteria in the sense that the Roman ruins there were already represented. Stonehenge-like monuments were already represented by Stonehenge. The fact that some writers like Wordsworth lived there didn't seem to be sufficient. Normally that would go, if I recall, the idea was that that would be a part of, but not sufficient justification in its own right for nomination. And although the natural area was attractive, it had been modified substantially by human activity over some couple of thousand years, or more, and so it really wasn't in an original evolving natural state, which didn't mean that when you put all of those together, you didn't have something that in itself was unique. It just didn't meet the rigid but narrow criteria laid out in the convention criteria. That eventually led to discussion, which started when I was chair, on what became known as, what are they known as now?
Cultural landscapes. Cultural landscapes?
Cultural landscapes, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, yes. I think the problem with the whole notion, the concept is easy to accept and understand. To apply the criteria to it then becomes more of a judgment than an easily measured analysis. In other words, how much impact of human activity? Has it evolved gradually over time with changes, ecological changes that are not abrupt, that allow an adaptive process? Is the human activity the mix of cultural events, activities, writings, are they such that taken together, you can add the points up and come to something better than a single criteria. I don't know. It's a tough thing, and I would hope the committee perhaps spends a few more hours on those than would be the case normally for a fairly straightforward natural or cultural proposal. I think the idea is warranted. I just think it's much more difficult to get your mind around. And in all cases, you really have to go back to the criteria and the procedures laid out in the operating procedures to be able to be sure and to be satisfied that you have given it a fair shake.
Jim, do you remember how it came to be that this issue was known in sort of 1984, 85 as rural landscapes? Do you know how it then shifted to be cultural landscapes? Because that's a different concept. Do you remember how that happened? It happened time, I think.
Yeah, I think it happened because there was a concern that rural left out the more remote areas. Rural implies an agrarian kind of society and use. In many parts of the world, whereas there are some natural areas with population nodes that taken together can still represent an integrated kind of landscape. I think the original discussion of rural probably described the situation better, but it was perceived to be too narrow by some people, even though I don't know if it ever became an issue in terms of actually looking at proposals.